The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Peter Rollins is the guest this week, and we discuss his book, The Divine Magician, The Disappearance of Religion and the Discovery of Faith, which came out from Howard Books, an imprint of Simon & Schuster, in January of this year, 2015. Rob Bell, the author of Velvet Elvis, blurbed the book this way. He says, "What Pete does in this book is take you to the edge of a cliff, where you can see how high you are and how far you would fall if you lost your footing. And just when most writers would kindly pull you back from the edge, he pushes you off." It's Wednesday, March 4th, 2015, and I'm Douglas Lane, the host of Zero Squared and the publisher of Zero Books. I want to take a moment before the interview with Peter Rollins to mention the passing of Leonard Nimoy. I feel similarly to how I felt when Johnny Carson died, only maybe more so. In a way, the death of Leonard Nimoy is like the death of Ronald McDonald. It feels like something that wasn't supposed to ever happen. Anyhow, searching around for a decent Spock quote to read in tribute, what I found instead is a quote that sets up my conversation with Peter Rollins.
"She is yours. After a time, you may find that having is not so pleasing a thing after all as wanting. It is not logical, but it is often true."
In this episode, you'll be hearing from a YouTube magician, a clip from the David Fincher movie The Game, from the Woody Allen movie The Purple Rose of Cairo, from a lecture by the Death of God theologian Thomas Altucher, I think I always mispronounced that name, and from Late Night with David Letterman. The music you're listening to right now is Music to Watch Space Girls By from the album Mr. Spock's Music from Outer Space. But in just a moment, you'll be hearing Peter Rollins and I discuss magic tricks and the big other. Peter Rollins is a writer, philosopher, and public speaker who has gained an international reputation for overturning traditional notions of religion and forming churches, in quotes, that preach the good news that we can't be satisfied, that life is difficult, and that we don't know the secret. He is the author of several books, including The Idolatry of God, Insurrection, and most recently, The Divine Magician, which came out from Simon & Schuster in January. Peter Rollins, welcome to Zero Squared.
It's great to be on the show.
So your latest book is The Divine Magician, and your other titles include The Idolatry of God, The Orthodox Heretic, and How Not to Speak of God. According to Wikipedia, your project is to short-circuit the categories of theism. What is radical theology, which is something else you're associated with, and what does it mean to short-circuit something like theism?
Yeah, I guess to approach radical theology, which, you know, I know you've covered on your show a few times, there's an anecdote from Belfast, where I'm from, that I think is quite insightful. During the Troubles, one of the techniques of the IRA was to plant an incendiary device in like a shopping center. And then they would phone the police and they'd say, "Listen, you've got 5 minutes or you've got 10 minutes to get everybody out." So at the time, you know, humor is used in order to deal with conflict situations. And there was a joke going around my school that there was this IRA guy who died and went to heaven. And he's standing at the pearly gates. And as he's standing there, St. Peter comes out with a big book, lays it on the ground, opens it up, and looks for the guy's name. And he says, "Listen, this is the book of life. Your name's not in it. You're in the IRA. You're going to have to go to hell." And this guy says, no, you misunderstand. He says, I'm not trying to get in. You've got 5 minutes to get out. I think this anecdote really gets to the heart of what radical theology is. Most theology is about trying to get to heaven, trying to get to the absolute, trying to escape the earth. But in a sense, radical theology is about trying to get the absolute into the earth, to say that the sacred is found in the depth dimension of life itself, not as some object you grasp, but rather as a sense of density and commitment to the world.
How did you come to radical theology? Did your understanding that theology needed to be turned on its head, so to speak, come to you in a flash as a kind of divine revelation itself? Or was it a longer process?
Yeah, I mean, it's happened over time, primarily because I think the actual existing church is primarily interested in trying to reestablish a lost harmony, get us back to some original blessing, reconnect us with the source of the universe, give us a sense of plenitude. And when I first entered into Christianity, it was through a kind of conversion into the charismatic evangelical world. And that message was there. But increasingly, I became convinced that the opposite direction is healthier and better for people, which is that we need to learn to live with our lack, that we need to actually distance ourselves from the idea that there's something out there, whether it's God or money or a partner that we think will satisfy us and make us whole. The more I looked into things, especially psychoanalytic theory, I realized that pursuit of wholeness is actually what can create a lot of depression, a lot of suffering, and a lot of political violence.
So your interest in psychoanalysis, did that lead you to seek analysis yourself? Have you been psychoanalyzed?
Yeah, so I started studying Lacanian psychoanalysis, and then I underwent 2 years of psychoanalysis. I'd probably keep doing it if I could afford it. The problem is it's quite expensive, so I'm currently not in analysis.
When you were in analysis, was that something you pursued as part of your training to become a psychoanalyst yourself?
Well, I mean, that was probably my conscious justification, because I didn't want to admit to myself that I was suffering. But no, in many ways, my whole journey has always been personal. My theological approach is personal. My psychoanalytic interest is personal. I'm trying to learn how to live well. As I do that, I try to write about that journey in more abstract terms. If I gave the creation mythology of psychoanalysis or Lacanian psychoanalysis, it would be like this. We experience very early on a sense of loss, a disconnect from the primary caregiver. If this doesn't happen, if we remain too close to our primary caregiver and there's no separation psychologically, that results in psychosis. So psychosis is really where the ego hasn't formed in separation to, you know, often they call it the mother with a capital O. You know, because often the mother concretely is what stands in for this sense of loss. So this is called the no of the father. The no of the father is basically something comes between you and the primary caregiver and says, no, you cannot be everything for them and they cannot be everything for you. If that happens, but there's a second step, and the second step is called the name of the father. And in the name of the Father, you find a way to articulate your primary caregiver's desires, what they want, and you realize that you're not all of their desire. Because at first you're alienated. That's the no of the Father. You experience alienation from the other. But you still want to be everything for the other. You still feel like maybe you could fulfill them. But in the name of the Father, you realize that you can't. The other is just as broken and fragile as you. And if that doesn't happen, perversion results. So perversion is kind of like the second stage where the person wants to be everything for the other. And if both alienation and separation happen, then neurosis results. And neurosis is often an acceptance that we can't go back to some primordial lost whole, but it also is a protest against that. And in psychoanalysis, there's often a thing called traversing the fantasy, and that is where we realize that the thing we're protesting against, the thing that we think will make us whole and complete, doesn't exist. Now, that for me is analogous to religion, that we often feel that we are separated from some primordial source. And if we don't gain enough separation from that, there's a type of religious psychosis, delusions, certainty, feeling that we're speaking on behalf of the divine. By the way, Darren Aronofsky is a brilliant director who explores religious psychosis in Pi and in Noah. Then there's religious perversion, which is often where you go, okay, God, we can't go back to the original source. God is bigger than we can ever imagine. But still, people are obsessed with having some sort of oneness and wholeness with that unspeakable other. And then, of course, there's religious neurosis. And in The Divine Magician, my argument is that we need to replicate the cure of psychoanalysis. And that is where we realize that the other does not exist, the big other. And that doesn't mean atheism in the traditional sense, but it means a form of taking responsibility for your actions, for your lack, and enjoying your lack. If I can use an analogy that I use in the book, Adam and Eve, I think the Hebrew scriptures begin with an object that is prohibited that Adam and Eve dearly want. It's just a mundane piece of fruit, but because it's prohibited, they really want it. They desire it. If only we could have this fruit, everything would be great. Oscar Wilde said there's only one thing worse than not getting what you want, and it's getting what you want. And so Adam and Eve get what they want, and they realize it doesn't fulfill. It causes all manner of problems. And in the book, I basically say that the temple in Jerusalem is set up like the Garden of Eden. There's the court of Gentiles where everyone can walk freely, just like Adam and Eve in the garden can walk freely. Then there's the Holy of Holies. That's like the thing that will make us whole and complete. Between us, there's a barrier, which is a massive curtain. But in Christianity, the curtain rips, and we realize that there's nothing there behind the curtain. The thing that we think will make us whole and complete doesn't exist. And we are that's the destitution you're talking about. That's the nihilistic moment. But the trick doesn't end there. You know, and I go on to talk about the next act, you know, what happens after that destitution.
In that pocket, you're going to find a $1 bill, put back together, but missing one corner. The tear on that bill is going to match the tear on this corner exactly. Both serial numbers will be the same, proving it to be the bill we started with. Are you ready, sir?
Yeah.
One. Two. Three, reach into that left-hand pocket where you're going to find a $1 bill put back together but missing one corner. The tear's going to match, the serial numbers will be the same, proving it to be the bill we started. I wouldn't... Whoa, man.
Then the magic trick, the second part, is the turn, where the magician strips away the curtain. What I want to argue is in that moment, we realize there's nothing there. What's called God is dead. Central moment of Christianity is the realization that there is nothing behind the curtain that will make you whole and complete. The thing that you think will do it is an illusion, is a fantasy. I'm not concerned with critiquing religion as such, because it's secularism that promises wholeness and completeness. I mean, I live in LA. I've never been in a more religious place in the world. My friend Kester Bruin has just written a book called Getting High, and it's about the history of actually aviation, but also the history of people wanting to get high, to get off the earth, to escape their suffering and brokenness. This is a universal problem that I'm interested in addressing.
Isn't the idea that we could accept our brokenness in itself a striving after wholeness? I mean,
yes, it definitely can be. I mean, that's the amazing thing, is anything can be a defense mechanism. I have a friend who has low self-esteem, has shame, and actually one of the defenses against it is if, for example, he lets me down, Like once he was late for me repeatedly, and I said, "You're always late for me." His defense was, "Yes, absolutely, I'm a terrible person." And I had to say, "Stop saying you're a terrible person, because I want to say you're a terrible person. You saying you're a terrible person defends and protects you from hearing me saying that, you know?"
Right.
And see this in psychoanalysis, they had this problem once people knew psychoanalytic interpretations. You know, at first you said to somebody, "Why did you beat that person up?" And they went, "Oh, I don't know, I just didn't like how they looked." And then 20 years later, you get someone and you say, "Why did you beat them up?" And they say, "Oh, I had a terrible relationship with my mother." But it doesn't remove the symptom. You know, the kind of, in a sense, having an awareness of your traumatic past had no influence on shifting the symptomatic violent outburst. So for me, yes, people can kind of embrace this kind of theology or this approach as exactly a defense. Like for example, 17-year-old goths do, where they strangely embrace a lack, but in a way that somehow is deeply painful and pleasurable at the same time. I want to get beyond all of that to a place where we can just have satisfaction living and not get into that perverse kind of satisfaction and dissatisfaction.
So you were talking before, you mentioned before that what your approach to Christianity is not the normal or mainstream kind of atheist approach to religion in general, which is just to say, yeah, that's all bunk, there is nothing, and we're going to just throw this aside. You still find something of value in the Christian tradition. And I saw you debate or talk to, not really debate, Lawrence Krauss, is that his name?
Yes.
He seemed to be exhibiting all of the problems that you were trying to raise about atheism, while nonetheless always being basic, never saying anything that wasn't right, you know?
Yes.
So
yes,
it was very frustrating. And also, from the beginning, his attitude, just in his posture and all of that towards you, was really dismissive and patronizing, and like he had you pegged. He didn't know what you were saying, but he already had you pegged, I guess, ahead of time. So it was frustrating to watch. But what did you think of that encounter?
Oh, my goodness. It was the weirdest encounter I ever had. And behind the scenes was even worse than what was on stage. I felt I was in an evangelical meeting of atheists. It was a strange debate that he was supposed to do a 10-minute response, and he just didn't. You know, he didn't do any research, and it was just kind of a strange example of two people in incommensurable worlds. But yeah, I mean, this is why I think for me Christianity is so important. Is I'm not arguing for atheism or theism. I find those debates relatively uninteresting. I'm arguing against what Lacan calls the big other. And for me, the big other is that thing that we all conspire, to, like the superego. It kind of controls us. It influences us. An example would be going to a nightclub really late at night, 3 o'clock in the morning, and everyone's dancing and having fun. But really, when you look at it, at 3 o'clock in the morning, everyone's exhibiting symptoms that makes it look like they're not having fun. The way they're holding their drink or holding their phone, and you feel like if you turn the lights on and turn the music off, half the room would be, if they looked each other's in the eye, would be crying, you know? So who are we trying to fool? We all know that, but we're all trying to fool something. And that's the big other. The big other is the non-existent thing that we somehow are all trying to fool. I mean, an example would be Training Day, the film, where a rookie cop goes out training with this veteran, and he's naive. He thinks that the cops are out there to take drug dealers off the streets, but he discovers that the whole system is corrupt over time. But the interesting thing is the corrupt cops can never say that they're corrupt. It has to all be hidden. Even though we, the viewer, and everybody knows, there has to be someone who we keep in the dark. And, that's kind of an example of this big other, this thing that, and what we need to do is we need to speak the stuff that we're hiding from this big other. That's the kind of psychoanalytic insight, in a sense, is you know, if a family are exhibiting, they all have bitterness and hatred, there's affairs going on, but nobody talks about it. Everybody knows stuff's going on, but nobody talks about it. The first step for that relationship to change is to bring all of the stuff to the surface and talk about it. And then the relationship will either collapse or the people will find a new way to relate to each other. But the system cannot stay the same. And for me, secularism, atheism, as much as theism, the sacred and the secular worlds operate with this big other. And that's what Christianity attacks.
It seems to me that whenever you try to give up on the big other, you're always performing that act of renunciation for some new or maybe even the same one, the same big others. Like, I've had moments where I've thought to myself, oh, there is, you know, I am alone in the universe, and what's happening to me now is only, you know, I'm self-contained, and there's no one watching me and judging how I behave. And then I think to myself, isn't that right, God?
Yeah, yes.
And so it's very hard for me to imagine not feeling ultimately as if I'm on stage or somehow, you know, performing for some agency. And yes. And I don't consider myself to be religious, but I just have noticed that maybe it's peculiar to me, particularly. I mean, maybe I'm a exceptionally pronounced case. You know, I do a podcast and I write books, so obviously I'm performing all the time. But I do feel like it's very difficult to get beyond the gaze of the other and the big other.
Absolutely. I mean, the reason why Christianity interests me is because a number of reasons. First of all, you know, this is not an intellectual thing for me. At the level of the ego, at the level of the imaginary, I don't mind if people believe in God or don't. It's at a symbolic level is what we're talking about. At this level, like, do we act? Do we kind of abdicate our responsibility for acting in the world? And what's interesting for Zizek, Zizek was the one who really turned me on to this, is, you know, it's not enough to not believe in something. There's an old English saying that there was once an Englishman who was so brave, not only did he not believe in ghosts, he wasn't even afraid of them. Right? And, you know, so you see this a lot. Darren Brown, the hypnotist and magician, does this, where he showed once that when by locking people in a crypt of a church, he didn't believe in God, he didn't believe in ghosts, they got really afraid, thinking there were things walking around them, you know. Mm-hmm. So they were enacting this. It's that symbolic level that I'm interested in. And for Zizek, you know, it's not that you stop believing in, say, that money will bring you happiness, because you can stop believing in that and yet somehow continue to act as if it does. The issue is money itself has to stop believing. You know, the system itself has to auto-deconstruct. And in Christianity, it's God who experiences the loss of God. It's God who experiences the lack within God. So for me, what's interesting and what I'm trying to do with actually setting up communities is to enact this auto-deconstruction, to bring people into a space where we don't talk about whether God exists or not. We don't intellectually talk about existentialism. We create practices that help us confront our hidden desires, confront our anxieties and our brokenness, bring that stuff to the surface, and not create some other that somehow protects us from the trauma of that confrontation.
Blake's self-annihilation of God fully correlates with Hegel's absolute self-negation. Both are purely and comprehensively kenotic or self-emptying movements, and both are genuinely and fully apocalyptic movements, thereby recovering a lost and original apocalyptic Christianity. And just as Blake enacts a total imaginative vision, comprehending everything to which it could possibly be open, Hegel's is the only truly total philosophical system in the world, comprehending everything within its own horizon. The Phenomenology of Spirit, 1807, is the first philosophical enactment of the death of God. thereby revolutionizing philosophy. But here, the death of God becomes possible and actually real only when spirit has realized itself in its most negative mode and epiphany. Only when spirit exists wholly in self-alienation and self-estrangement can it undergo an ultimate movement of self-negation.
In this particular book, The Divine Magician, you use magic as your primary metaphor to explain a lot of these Lacanian concepts, I think.
Yes.
In your book, you seem to say that religion is a magic trick, an illusion. But you have a fondness for illusions, and you seem to prefer magic tricks to real magic.
Yeah. So, I mean, initially it was, again, Zizek who put me onto this idea of a magic trick. But then I looked more deeply into it and I realized some other interesting connections. So there was an archbishop in the 1600s who noticed that the magicians would say hocus pocus at the key point of the magic trick. And he noticed that that's very similar to hoc est corpus, what the priest says during Mass when the bread and the wine turn into the body and blood of Christ. And so for him, he was like saying, the magicians are mocking the Eucharist. They're mocking the Lord's Supper and they're mocking Christianity. And I was thinking, well, no, actually, maybe the magicians are right. Maybe the Eucharist can be understood as a magic trick because the Eucharist has three parts. The first part is the bread and the wine, which is the sacred. Here's a mundane object that we invest with sacred, infinite value. This is God right in front of us that we can touch, taste, feel, smell. And that's the pledge of the trick. Because, you know, if you've seen the film The Prestige, the first part of the magic trick is a pledge, an object. The second part is the turn, the disappearance of the object. And in the Eucharist, that's when you consume the bread and the wine, and it disappears, just like the magician's dove. Mm-hmm. But then there is the prestige, and the prestige is the third part of the trick. And the trick isn't over until you bring back what was lost. Now, of course, in a magic trick, what returns is rarely what was made to disappear. If I make a coin disappear, the one back underneath your cup, you know, that when I lift up your cup and there it is, I planted that earlier. You know, it's not the same coin. It just looks like the same. And so in the prestige of Christianity, I argue that we wait for the return of the sacred. And then we get up from our seats and we shake the hands of the person to your right and to your left. And we ask how their week was and we try to help them out if they're struggling. And we remember about their divorce or remember about the birth of their child. And we realize that that is the prestige, that we are the body and blood of God in the world, that we are the enactment of the sacred. That, for me, summarizes the move of Christianity. We take the transcendent, whatever object we think will make us whole and complete. It disappears, and we experience the trauma of that loss. And then it kind of reappears as a depth dimension in the midst of life itself. I'll say it in one slightly different way. It's a difference between sublimation and idealization. You know, in idealization, you have an object that you think is perfect. If you are going out with somebody and you idealize them, they can do nothing wrong. But the problem with that type of relationship is eventually something does go wrong. And, you know, again, in LA, you see this all the time. People go from one relationship to the next looking for the perfect one. In sublimation, you still look at the other person as in some way perfect and infinite in value, but in their imperfections. It's like parents who say, my child is the most beautiful child in the world. If you point out that the child's got big ears and is actually quite ugly, they obviously are going to get annoyed at you, but you're misunderstanding what they're saying. They're not literally saying that their child is the most beautiful child in the world, you know, descended from the heavens. They're saying that in their child's imperfections, they experience at a subjective level perfection. And that for me is, idealization is when we say God is out there, or some object is out there that will make us whole, to the idea of sublimation, which is the imperfect world is experienced as having depth and density and beauty and meaning.
Do you think that your version of Christianity ruins the trick? Because, in a magic trick, what makes it a wondrous thing is your misidentification of the object. I mean, you think the object went behind the curtain and then disappeared, but really it's been, it either was never behind the curtain or it's been zipped away. And you're asking the audience to realize that sense of wonder wasn't something that the magician created, but it's something that they invested into the trick.
But, we all know that when we go to a magic trick, yeah. A magic show now. So the wonder is not taken away. Again, in The Prestige, I think it mentions this. It says, if we really believed that when the magician saw the woman in half, that some demonic or angelic forms had actually made this happen, we'd run out of the place screaming. But we applaud. We applaud because of the skills, because we've been fooled, because of the awe and wonder that we receive. And yet virtually nobody in the room thinks that it was anything but a sleight of hand. So for me, I'm interested in the theory and the technology. So I'm interested in the theory of Christianity, exploring what it's doing, the death of the big other and embrace of the world and the political outworkings of that. But I'm also interested in the technology, which is creating structures that enact this trick. So my books are, in a sense, trying to go, here's how the magic trick works, so that those people who want to create those communities where the death of the big other is enacted kind of have some tools at their disposal. But I don't think it takes away from the world transformative and the personally transformative nature of those communities.
In the 70s, there was a movement in the arts and in literature. People like Kurt Vonnegut and Coover wanted to write books that would always be exposing the techniques that were used to create a fictional world and always let the reader in on the fact. I do this sometimes, too. They always want to let the reader in on the fact that, look, I'm pulling the wool over your eyes. This is a trick. There is no character really like this. I've made these words up. But what's amazing about those books is that they still satisfy, at least for me, all of the things that a book that's told in a more conventional way, that would satisfy. You still get invested in the characters, even though you know that they're not real. It doesn't actually pull much, it doesn't really demystify the text to use those techniques. So I wonder if... are you aiming at demystifying the religious tradition, or are you aiming at doing something like what Coover and Vonnegut were doing in the 70s, creating a new tradition that would still hold that sense of wonder for people, but let them in on the trick more?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. But my main project is to try to say that Christianity in its contemporary form is actually kind of going about the wrong thing. It's trying to reestablish a lost harmony. It's trying to reestablish a connection with the source or ground of all being. But the church in its radical form should be trying to help us tarry with that lack, take the sting out of it, and let us live. So in some ways I'm trying to demystify the trick, but in most ways I'm trying to say, listen, if you're a religious leader, people will come to you saying, I want you to make me better. Just like in psychoanalysis, somebody goes in and says, either explicitly or implicitly, they demand that you fix them. make me better, get rid of my symptom. I can't work. I'm really bad in relationships. But the analyst over time has to help them realize that you can't just fix the symptom. The symptom is not the problem. It's the solution to a problem. You know, the reason why you drink so much or the reason why you have explosions of anger is because of some unresolved issues. And at that point, people generally want to run away from analysis. They're like, oh, I didn't realize that we had to do that work. I didn't realize that we had to open that Pandora's box. And a lot of people leave. But the analyst works with them, helps them gradually look at those early issues, bring them to the surface, helps the analyzand to accept some of those things and to look at them and to learn to live with them. And then they break up with the analyst and they re-enter the world. And in the same way in church, people are like, I want you to help me. I want you to make me better. And I don't think the priest says, no, I can't do it. But what they do is they create an environment where through the music and the prayer, the liturgy, all of these tools, through comedy, through through the sermon, through storytelling, they create an atmosphere where the person can begin to look at the terror that is in their mind, the anxieties and the conflicts that are within, bring them to the surface so that they can learn to accept them and live in a healthier way.
When you say that the reason that people drink is because they have unresolved issues that they haven't dealt with yet, it almost sounds as though that you could deal with them completely. I hear that kind of talk, and I think that people are saying, oh, you know, you're just cowardly not looking at these issues or what have you. But one of your points is that these issues, this brokenness, this unresolved problem, that's up there in heaven. That's, you know, that's in the foundation of our life, to put it in the opposite way. So you're not going to actually be able to solve the problem, can confront it, solve it, put it to bed, and be done, right? I mean, that's not what you're saying. You're talking about facing it in order to live with it on your own terms or on new terms or consciously.
Yeah, you never get to a point where there's no repression. I mean, a healthy community for me is not a community that has no, you know, darkness or repressed issues, but a community where on a regular basis it's able to bring those things to the surface and look at them and work with them. So there is no perfection. There's a little story that I think captures this about a guy who was on a desert island for 20 years on his own, and eventually he's rescued. And before he's taken off the island, one of the people who rescued him says, can you show us where you lived? So this guy takes him to a clearing, and in the clearing there's a building, and he says, oh, you know, this is my house. It's got running water, and I lived there for years. And the rescuer sees that beside it there's another building, and he says, what's that? And the guy says, well, I'm a very religious man, he says, and that's where I go to pray, that's my church. And then the rescuer sees another building beside it and says, what's that third building? And the guy says, I don't want to talk about it. He says, no, come on, what is it? He says, I don't want to talk about it. Come on. He says, oh, he says, that's a church I used to go to. A terrible place, right? But what I love about this story is I think it expresses how we all want to basically engage in the defense of splitting, of saying they're bad, that old church I went to, or that one group of people, they're terrible and I'm innocent. Or if we break up with someone psychologically to deal with the terror and the heart and the pain, we often say they're evil and bad and awful and I'm innocent. And a good friend doesn't say, no, you're wrong. But neither do they say you're right. They listen to you, and at a key moment, they say, you know, I just think you're hurt. You know, I just think you're in pain. And if that's said at the right time, the person can begin to get over the defensive splitting, which was actually a useful thing for them. You know, that's the thing. You have to be sensitive to defenses are there for a reason. But that be able to put their defenses down and look at the pain that's behind that and begin to deal with it. When we're kids, we split. The monster is under our bed. And as we get older, we realize the monster is not under our bed. The monster is us.
Tom, is this Celia, you're throwing away perfection.
Don't tell her that. We need Tom back.
It's so romantic.
Women.
I'm crushed. I'm devastated. It's...
Tom, try to understand. You'll be fine. In your world, things have a way of always working out right. See, I'm a real person, and no matter how tempted I am, I have to choose the real world. I loved every minute with you. And I'll never forget our night on the town.
Goodbye.
Can we get on with the Purple Rose of Cairo, please?
Anyone wants me, I'll be in real sick.
Kitty's waiting for you.
Lord have mercy. What a day. What
a day. Psychoanalysis for me, like existentialism, which I'm also influenced by, kind of in one sense have deep connections with the Jewish and Christian tradition. So in some ways, I don't feel like I'm bringing Lacan to the text. I feel in many ways Lacan is, for me, shining a light on things that are already in the text. And for me, you know, Christianity and the Jewish and Christian traditions, they are privileged in some respects for me, but they're privileged in the same way that a parent says, my child is the most beautiful child in the world. There's two comedians, Mitchell and Webb from the UK, and they have a little sketch that's brilliant where it's a wedding, and the groom toasts to his wife and says, to the most beautiful woman in the world. And then he sits down, and the best man is about to start his speech. And he says, before I start, you know, I just want to say, like, you know, the most beautiful girl in the world. I mean, not really. And the people in the audience go, boo. And he goes, like, what? Like, do you really think she's the most beautiful woman in the world? I mean, like, are you deluded? And then somebody else boos him and he says, listen, if she was the most beautiful woman in the world, the paparazzi would be here. We'd be drinking champagne and not Prosecco. And he goes on to basically, you're all deluded thinking she's the most beautiful woman in the world. And I like the sketch because he's kind of like the fundamentalist, like not understanding that the groom is saying something radically subjective. So for me, we're all thrown into a language and a series of texts and a history. And in a way, I echo what Vadimo says when someone asks, why are you a Christian? Because he's a type of secular Christian. And he says, well, how could I not be? I was nurtured on these texts, the Western philosophical tradition, which has been so influenced by, you know, Christianity, etc. So in some ways, like René Girard, I privilege the text. But in that way, oh, and the other reason why I do it is because if you can influence actual existing Christianity, you can influence and transform countless lives, and it can be an Archimedean point that you can use to create real social and political change.
Yeah, you're anticipating my final question here, Peter. That's cheating, but because I'm going to the what I want to ask you now is why Christianity, and I'm going to be that fundamentalist. You know, it's like you think Christianity is the most important tradition in the world. I mean, you really think so? I mean, this woman hasn't been important since the French Revolution. Look how old she is. This is who you want to marry? Come on now. Why would you focus all your energy on this hag when you've got the sexy thing called capitalism that you could be critiquing instead and bringing that to? But seriously, is short-circuiting Christianity, which is your aim here, really the most of is that going to be the linchpin for social change that you just talked about, or isn't it the case now that the belief that we don't have to believe in isn't Christianity more? That's a belief that we proclaim, and, you know, on the level of appearance, but the belief that really structures our actions is on the economic level and on the political level, and it's this capitalist state that we that is the structure that really works in the world now. So why Christianity? I'll just ask it.
I mean, my friend Castor said it well recently, Castor Bruin. He said that Christianity is a mechanism for the killing of gods. And what he kind of means is that in Christianity, and in radical Christianity we're talking about here, what one does is gradually over time learn to kill the sovereign. Any sovereign big other who is out there, who is making demands on us, that he has actually a brilliant reading of the prodigal son, which we all know, where the son goes out and the father eventually welcomes him back and everything's wonderful. Well, for Kester, we actually have to read this as a tragedy, that this is not Christianity. The prodigal son is the failure. So in other words, a very wealthy family who have no need, no hunger, right? They're in this, and especially at that time where the disparity between wealthy and poor is even more than we know today, that there will be, they'll have slaves, they'll have servants, people outside the grounds will be starving. And the youngest says, I want to go out into the world and experience it. Basically, Kester says, go to university, take his parents' money and get drunk, you know? And so he does, he goes out, he sees a world of suffering and pain. Eventually, he's eating scraps off a trough, and he says, I'll go back to the house. But he says, I won't go back as a son, I'll go back as an honest laborer. I'll do an honest day's work for an honest day's pay. But on the way back, his father hears he's returning. Now, his father hasn't been out looking for him. It's not like other parables where the shepherd goes out in search of one sheep. The father is in the safe confines of the home. But he runs to the edges thinking, like any conservative father, what's my son picked up at liberal university? You know, what crazy ideas is he coming back with? And so he doesn't let the guy speak. He stops him before he can utter a word and says, oh, you're cold. Put this cloak on. Oh, put this ring of power on. This place is yours. And you must be starving. Here, have some food. We have a fattened calf for you. And he returns and nothing changes. He's reintegrated into the family. And Kester, you know, contrasts this with something like Star Wars, where Darth Vader says exactly the same to Luke Skywalker. We can rule the universe together. Just come back. But Luke Skywalker says no. That's the pirate move. He says no, and he actually converts the father. And what Kester does is he reads Christ against the prodigal. Also a family of three that knew no poverty, knew no suffering. The son goes out into the world, experiences poverty and pain. And just like the prodigal can return home, it says that he can call on the messengers of the father and he'll be brought back. But this time something changes. And the son says, no, where are you, Father? Why have you forsaken me? And the barrier that separates the enclosed place of wealth from the dirt and grime of the world is ripped in half. The Father is converted and brought into the world. And we realize that where two or three are gathered together in love, there is the divine. Now, if you can bring people through that journey in a year, 2 years liturgically, that is the training ground for killing any big other, secular. I mean, for me, in a sense, Christianity is you learn to go through that process religiously, and then you can go through that process politically and culturally. And in fact, my next book is probably going to be a critique of secularism, of how, you know, secularism thinks that it's free of the big other, free of ideology, but it's knee deep in it. In fact, here's just the closing analogy. Again, it's another little story, a little parable about a competition where you have three people are asked to build a sheep pen, and they're given a certain amount of materials and a certain amount of time, and they have to see who can make the best and biggest. The first person's an engineer, and they build with the materials. They know the strengths. They know that they can cut it in half, and they can hold ultimately 100 sheep with the sheep pen they build. Next is an architect. And she is actually able to build something that can house 150 sheep. But finally, there's this Irish guy, Seamus, and he just spends the day sunbathing, gets an Irish tan, you know, which is red, and he doesn't do any work. And eventually, when the judges are coming, he quickly gets up and makes a little tiny box, and he's standing in it and painting it. And the judges say to him, you know, what are you doing? That's tiny. You couldn't even fit one sheep in that box. And Seamus says, he says, no, you don't understand. He says, I'm on the outside. You're standing in it, right? That, for me, is the Christian insight, is that people laugh at the church and say, you're standing in ideology. You're in the very heart of the big other. And the radical church's response is, no, you don't understand. You're standing in the midst of ideology. The radical church is the point in which we experience the loss of the big other.
Well, I think that the dog is a good indication that we're done here. But the last thing I'll just say to you is, it sounds to me like you are all about, I mean, you're not a liberation theologist per se, but you're all about trying to liberate people, not from the church, but to use the church as a tool of liberation. Would you?
Absolutely. Now, you know, if people are listening to this, I don't necessarily mean the church that's at the bottom of their street. I mean those places, wherever they are, that break us free from some sovereign big other. Wherever that happens, I think that is infidelity to the Christ event.